call me hero when you see the medals that I wear. Medals maketh not the hero, they just prove that I was there. Do not call me hero now that I'm old and grey. I left a lad, returned a man, they stole my youth that day. Do not call me hero when you ran the wall of hell, the blood, the fears, and cries, the tears, we left them where they fell. Do not call me hero, each night I stop and pray, for all the friends I knew and lost, I survived my longest day. Do not call me hero in the years that passed, for all the real true heroes have crosses lined upon the grass.
That was the voice of D-Day veteran Harry Billinge, who passed away aged 96 on the 5th of April 2022. And Harry will always be remembered as the man that raised £50,000 for the British Normandy Memorial that now stands very proudly overlooking Gold Beach, and which was the focal point of so many of the D-Day commemorations, D-Day 80 commemorations that I visited along with so many others last week. So welcome to the second episode of a series all about those commemorations in Normandy last week, when we pick out just a few of the stories that we looked at as we travelled the battlefields over the course of 3 full days. And we're starting off this week on Gold Beach at that very memorial. Beautiful afternoon summer's weather when we arrived there. It was very, very busy. There was coaches and cars from all over the world, I suppose. You could hear lots of different nationalities. After we parked in the car park and made our way up the path towards the memorial, towards Gold Beach or the cliffs that overlook Gold Beach, we also saw passengers from cruise ships that had docked in places like Le Havre or river cruises. They were there too, all come to see what people like Harry Billinge had considered so important to them that made him want to raise all that money. After he died in 2022, Harry's family released this statement. They said Harry was a very loving husband who looked after Mum. He was steadfast in his love for her. As a dad, he taught us great values, honesty, kindness, generosity, and not to judge. Dad was always there to guide us. He was always a very charitable man and collected for the Poppy Appeal for over 65 years. When he got the brochure about the British Normandy Memorial in the post, he felt compelled to start collecting. In his efforts to raise money for the memorial, he found great peace. The original idea was to collect £1 for each of his comrades that died on the beaches. That's 22,442. But of course, it amounted to much more than that. It gave him a purpose. Meeting with members of the public kept him going. In an interview with the BBC a few years ago on Remembrance Sunday, we recall him saying he just wanted to be remembered as a good old sapper who did his best. He also said, "I hope I shall live in the hearts of people who won't forget Harry." They go on to say that Harry wanted future generations to never forget his comrades who fell in Normandy. If members of the public would like to pay their respects to Harry, we ask that they become guardians of the British Normandy Memorial. And there's a link on the British Normandy Memorial website, if that's what you'd like to do. And also on that website is a short video which gives us more information and talks to some of those veterans and explains how they feel about this beautiful memorial.
There was a crew of just over 80 sailors, and we lost 31. The rest survived, and fortunately I survived as well, but I was seriously injured. At the time, the names of the 31 of the crew on one pillar.
It's my first D-Day in France as ambassador, and it's absolutely brilliant to be here. I spoke to Joe, who said that it was very moving for him to be here. I asked where he'd landed, and he said right here on this beach. To see the names on the walls, he said, just meant so much to him. He got a bit choked up. I got a bit choked up.
I was in the 4th Battalion Dorset Regiment, and we landed at Kosovo on the 23rd of June. I was very impressed. It's got an atmosphere, hasn't it? But I was all right until I found a colleague, and that threw me up. It's quite strange. I can stand at his grave and say a prayer, but when you see his name, that was it.
The emotion that comes through from the veterans here is so powerful. It communicates to everyone. And for us in the Trust, it just shows us that this project was not only worthwhile, in many ways it was long overdue.
I've been to see my friend that was shot, Cyril King, down there, and it was great. A few tears, and I kept trying to keep his head down, and he didn't, and he got shot right there. Keep the story alive. They should never let this die. Even the young generation should not let it die.
It's a very powerful place. It's absolutely beautiful in its simplicity of the design. My grandfather's youngest brother, he was 21 and he was killed on the beaches in 44. I thought maybe he might be on one of the columns. So I just looked on the website and put his name in, and sure enough, he is actually the first one we saw, amazingly, which was just, he's just there.
The actual first impression of this is actually marvellous. It couldn't have been done better. As I say, I get quite emotional, but that's me. What hits me when I'm walking around is when you see the ages, 19, 18, 20, you know what I mean? I've got grandkids older than that.
The memorial remembers those who fought and who lost their lives to bring freedom and liberty to Europe. But it's really important that we find a way of telling the story for future generations. And that's what we're thinking about at the present moment. Whatever it looks like, that's what it will do.
It is important to have a memorial like this for the future generations to come here and see the names of people that have given them this freedom. They owe quite a lot to these people who are named on these pillars, and they should really thank them for it.
We're going to look at two stories of two women that are commemorated on the British Normandy Memorial. But first of all, let me explain what we saw when we went beyond the memorial onto the cliffs that overlook D-Day itself. And most people would have seen these images on their televisions last week, because there we found 1,475 giant silhouettes in honour of the servicemen and women who fell on D-Day itself. This was a project that was set up by some volunteers, and they called this project Standing with the Giants. We see these silhouettes representing the three military services, the RAF, the Royal Navy and the Army, and each one stands just under 2 metres tall. And the idea is that these installations provide a space for people to do exactly what we did, to visit, reflect, grieve. And there was hundreds of people there when we were there, and they were discussing and talking about their own stories and what's taken them to Normandy for this special occasion. These silhouettes will be there until the end of August, which coincides with the end of the Battle of Normandy. And there's just two women there, and they'll be there forever, the two silhouettes of the women, because those silhouettes represent Molly Evershed and Dorothy Field. And it's their story that I want to talk about now. They were on board a hospital ship, the SS Amsterdam, and it had been going backwards and forwards for a few weeks between the Normandy beaches and Britain, taking the wounded men out of Normandy. And on the morning of the 7th of August 1944, the ship was just off Juno Beach. And Dorothy and Molly were two of the nurses that were helping the medics treat the badly wounded men. As they patrolled the makeshift wards within the ship, they treated head wounds, bandaged mutilated limbs, and do what nurses do, offer comforting words to the men. And then that morning, just as one of the ship's surgeons had completed a leg amputation, a terrible disaster struck. The minesweepers had cleared so many of those mines, hundreds and thousands of mines from beneath the surface of the English Channel. But clearly they hadn't cleared all of them. How could they? They didn't know where all of them were. And just as the SS Amsterdam was about to make its third trip home, it hit one of those mines. An almighty explosion tore through the 350-foot ship and it ripped it open as though it had been opened by a can opener. Everybody panicked. They would do, wouldn't they? Anyone would. The crew and the passengers fought to escape as the stricken vessel rapidly began to sink. They managed to lower some lifeboats into the water and many people piled in and they were filled up to bursting point, became a danger in themselves. And then in desperation, some of those men and women jumped into the sea. Molly and Dorothy had every chance to escape, but they didn't escape because they put their own safety last before everybody else. Molly was 27. She trained as a nurse in Norwich, racing below deck time and time again as the ship dangerously listed. The two of them helped carry wounded patients to the lifeboats. All but the most infirm had to climb three flights of stairs to the promenade deck, where one officer had made a gangplank of stretchers to a lifeboat, but others had to be hauled through the tiny portholes to safety. And between the two girls, they somehow managed to save 75 men. One of the last to be rescued was the very soldier whose leg had been amputated just before the explosion occurred. But sadly, their selfless heroism was to cost them their lives. Dorothy did actually reach a lifeboat when she made the fatal decision to go back one last time, but she was never seen again. We don't know exactly what happened to those nurses. After just 8 minutes from hitting the mine, the SS Amsterdam disappeared below the water, where she still lies. One survivor recalls seeing two people stuck in the portholes as the ship heeled over, and he was later told it was the two nurses. We have one account that survived from a galley boy who was on the ship. And he said in 2005, suddenly there was a muffled explosion, the lights went out and the ship listed. There was a horrible smell in the air. I could hear a lot of screaming and shouting. I looked round and I could see some of the wounded soldiers jumping over the side. As I continued paddling, I heard a gushing noise, then saw what looked like ashes shooting out of the funnel amid lots of noise. Then there was nothing. Just wreckage floating in the water and deathly silence. But although we don't know how those two girls perished, we don't know where their bodies are. They may still be within the wreck of the SS Amsterdam, below the waters, out from Juno Beach. We don't know any of that. But what we do know is that they will always be remembered now, because not only are their names recorded on the British Normandy Memorial, but those two silhouettes depicting the two nurses will be the only two silhouettes that will remain there forever. Because as the others are removed, no doubt to appear somewhere else, the two silhouettes for those two brave nurses will remain there, facing the British Normandy Memorial, remembering the names of those 22,000 men, and with their backs to Gold Beach, where several hundred of them died. It was a very, very special and emotional moment as we sat there in the sunshine, in the quietness, lots of people there, as I said, but it was still very, very quiet. And we looked at all of those silhouettes, but in particular, we looked at those two. Now, while we were overlooking Gold Beach, I thought of one of the very few veterans that I knew, a man called Harry Austin, who came from Northampton, my hometown. And I'd known Harry through the local football scene for, well, I don't know, 35 years at least, probably. And then one day we were sitting somewhere talking about football, and I started doing battlefield tours, and Harry got to hear about it, and he just said to me one day, he said, "I was there, you know." I said, "Where, mate?" He said, "Normandy, at Gold Beach." He says, "I was serving with the 2nd Battalion of the Essex Regiment, Bombardiers," he called them. And he said it was his 19th birthday when they arrived on Gold Beach in the afternoon of D-Day and made their way inland. And what they were supposed to be doing was attacking Bayeux. But when they got to Bayeux, it was dark and they were told to dig in. And that's what they did. And he spent the evening of his 19th birthday in what he said was a ditch. He said, but one of his mates, who he knew quite well, went mad. And he said he jumped on top of him and was shaking and screaming. He said, and the medics or the military police, he wasn't sure who, came along. They took him away and he never saw him again. The next day, the Germans withdrew from Bayeux. But Harry was there, and then he fought his way through the Normandy campaign. He told me horrendous stories. And then he found himself in Berlin after the war, where his service ended. I'd known Harry all those years. He'd never said a word. He was a little man in stature, but he'd obviously seen things that he couldn't begin to properly explain. And he wanted to go back. He'd never been back. He told me, he asked me, "Can you take me back, Terry?" So I said I would. Of course I would. How could you say no? And it was at a time when the Royal British Legion, I think it was, were arranging grants for veterans to go back to Normandy. So I went off, and a few weeks later I went over with a book that someone had written about his battalion. I recced the places that Harry said he'd been to. His memory had let him down to a certain extent, but we managed to trace exactly where he was. And I phoned him when I was on the ferry on the way back, but he didn't answer. So I phoned his daughter, and she said that he was ill in hospital. I went to see him in hospital. Harry, he was pleased to see me. I was pleased to see him. But the light had almost gone out. He never made it back to Normandy. Harry died just a few days later. So as I sat there, overlooking Gold Beach, I thought of my mate Harry. Just as I told him I would on the last time I saw him in that hospital in Northampton. So I found that book that Harry told me about, that somebody had written, The Pompadours, D-Day to VE Day in Northwest Europe, by a man called A.A. Vince, and he describes exactly what it was like to land on Gold Beach on D-Day. It was midday that their craft nosed their way onto the land, and we could see plainly the coastline, he says. Le Hamel, where we were due to land, was still not free, and it was thus necessary to go ashore some mile and a quarter to the east. The sea held much evidence of tragedies already enacted. Wrecks, landing craft and vehicles, disabled tanks, floating boxes and items of equipment. At 12:25, the leading craft grounded, the ramps went down and the men streamed ashore. Some into the water, only knee-deep, others up to their necks, but all made dry land, crossed the short stretch of shingle and clambered over the low seawall. According to plan, we formed up in boatloads and moved off to the prearranged assembly area, some 2.5 miles inland. On the rising ground to our left, we could see a long line of Shermans forming up, and we gasped as we saw they were parked almost head to tail. As we marched along, we saw and heard German beach defences still holding out, but our orders were to get inland, and we pushed on. Past small batches of prisoners we went, through minefields already gapped. Numbers of dead and wounded from both sides littered the roads, some hurriedly but efficiently dressed by the stretcher bearers, but others as yet untouched, and we could not help them. The roads along which we marched were now being shelled by 75s at short range, but casualties were few, and soon we came to the assembly area, quickly deployed and dug in for the first time. The area was in a small wood, not entirely clear, and the odd sniper was still operating. A row of large poplars caused us some trouble until a Sherman came up and one by one picked off the treetops where the snipers were concealed. And just as Harry had told me, the book confirms that Bayeux was indeed their objective that night. He says the book says only isolated and bewildered Boche were encountered, and without exception these decided that discretion was really the better part, and they also turned south and ran. Then we dug in, and during the night patrols we went out to look at the anti-tank ditch surrounding Bayeux. In the gathering dusk, as we looked at the spires of the cathedral, it seemed that the city was almost undefended, and the returning patrols confirmed this. Even so, it would have been a brave man that would have suggested that we should take Bayeux almost without a shot being fired. And to save being sorry afterwards, a limited left-flanking attack was laid on. At 1100 hours on the 7th of June, A Company went in supported by tanks of the Sherwood Rangers. Only a little sniping in the streets developed, and the offenders were quickly liquidated. By 1 o'clock, the town was secure, the companies deployed defensively, and the inhabitants sufficiently recovered from the shock to commence looting the German quartermaster stores. A few days later, the Pompadours were to be involved in a battle near Tilly, and the wood there, they called it Essex Wood, after Harry's battalion that suffered so much in Essex Wood. But that's a story for another day. So from there, we made our way to Juno Beach. And Juno's always remembered for the achievements of the 3rd Canadian Division, who managed to land over 21,000 men, over 3,000 vehicles on Juno Beach, despite the high seas caused by the storm. And they face stiff resistance from the Germans inside those enormous pillboxes there. And we did talk about that. My passengers went down onto the beach, and we looked at some of the individual stories that occurred. But it was just a few yards away was the main attraction that we'd come to see. Because in support of the Canadians that day were British. And one of them was a Churchill tank that was being used to clear obstacles on the beach. And the one that we'd come to see is still there. For many, many years, it had been buried beneath a road just a short distance away from where it had come to grief on D-Day. And it was that story that we'd come to learn about, the story of the tank known as One Charlie. It had managed to come ashore on Juno Beach on the morning of D-Day. The firm sand allowed tanks to move across and take out German positions. But unfortunately, One Charlie dropped into a 4-metre bomb crater that was concealed from its driver by a shallow flooded area that surrounded it. And there the Churchill tank remained, and the British and Allied troops that came ashore in the days that followed, they used the tank as a bridge support. And it remained buried there for 32 years until November 1976. A team of British Army soldiers and engineers extracted this Avery tank from its wartime grave. And two of the surviving members of the tank crew, driver Bill Dunn and Bill Hawkins, were present as it was lifted back onto the beach, where it now stands. It sits on top of a plinth and is a memorial to the brave soldiers, because not all of those soldiers survived the day. Bill Dunn himself died in 2014, and his ashes were scattered next to the tank on the 8th of November 2014. There are some incredible photographs of One Charlie being lifted out of the ground, and of those two crew members standing in front of the tank that they then unveiled. They unveiled it with a British Union flag that had been draped across it. It must have been an incredible feeling for those boys. Now old men, of course, in 1976. But I tell you what, you don't have to listen to me talking about it, because we can do now what we did with my group at the time. We can listen to the words of that man, Bill William Dunn, as he talked about what happened and how his mates were killed. After they'd escaped the flooded tank, after they'd gone back to the dunes, and when they thought they'd finally reached safety, tragically that wasn't to be the case.
But the water in the culvert, the waterproofing wasn't sufficient to stop the water in the culvert pouring in. Did you think you'd had it by drowning then?
I did, yeah. Like myself, I did, because I couldn't get out my driver's seat, you see, because the bassine was on top of the driver's hatch and the co-driver's hatch. So we couldn't get out that way. The only way we could get out of the tank was crawling back through into the turret and then out through the turret. See, the three lads that was already in the turret, well, they wished to get out. They had no problem. The explosive expert, Lance Corporal Hawkins, well, he had no problems. Because he was sitting behind me and he wished to get out of the turret. The problems we had was my co-driver and myself. Well, my co-driver was out before me. He crawled through and then I had to come through last.
You were very lucky, really.
I was very, very fortunate. I always class myself as fortunate.
And that's when your sergeant punched you in the stomach?
Bill Hawkins punched me in the stomach after I got out again and got rid of the water. Which might have tasted horrible. But I was thankful that Bill did it. I mean, I felt annoyed, a bit annoyed at first, but like anybody would, but I was thankful after to get rid of it.
And then you took shelter?
Yes, so we were escorted by the CO, his tank, escorted us back to, we were from the German side, you know, back to the sand dunes. That's when we got hit and lay down. We could see the mortar bomb, from where we were lying. We was at the crossroads. We fired the mortar from the crossroads. And it hit us, but we didn't know he was aiming for us, like, you know.
But before that, your sergeant tried to calm you all down with a song.
Yeah, he also has to sing Kiss Me Again. Well, it's two songs he also sing, was Kiss Me Again and...
Ah, dear one, how often I think of the past. Can it be you forget? Perchance 'twas a passion too wondrous to last, but I dream yet. I see you again as you gazed in my eyes with joy all alight. So fondly you'd fold me as softly you told me of love through the star-sprinkled night.
The other one was in an old Australian homestead.
You've all heard about sunny Queensland, a wonderful place I am sure, where the cane fields, the mountains, the rivers, and the islands just out from the shore. They tell of Tasmania's beauty, and Victoria's sights never fail. But my song is set in the mountains of northern New South Wales. I'm far from the cry of the city, far from the mad traffic roar, where the scent of the bush all around me is a coming right in my front door. There's a rainbow on Sugarloaf Mountain after the showers are gone. Here at my old Aussie homestead, it's here, boy, I say I belong.
He always tried to calm us down in any particular atmosphere, you know, the way he thought you were going to fight panic or anything like that. But this particular time, he knew exactly where we were and what we were doing, and he tried to calm us down on that.
How far from the tank were you back then?
I would say roughly about 40, 50 yards from the tank.
In the sand dunes?
Yeah.
Did people need calming down?
Well, I think so. I think we were too excited. Not excited, a difficult word, you know, to find. You were all tense, wondering what was happening because the bullets was flying all over the place and you could hear them ricocheting off the tank turrets. And bullets was flying and you're hitting the ground beside your feet as you were running. It's a difficult word to find exactly your feelings, you know, because you were... You were running to get away from the bullets, and as you dropped down, you know, you were looking to find out where you were and trying to see where the firing was coming from, actually. But as you dug down, I think we were all a bit breathless, and I think Jim must have thought we were all getting a bit panicky. Possibly in his eyes we were, I don't know. But he started to sing, and we just went all settled down just there. We thought, well, we'll lie here and then until the other tanks come forward, and then we'll be able to do something. Well, unfortunately, it didn't work that way.
That's when the mortar bomb dropped.
Yeah.
From what you said, it sounds as though you didn't become unconscious straight away then.
I was conscious all day.
And did it hurt when you were first hit?
Yeah. Well, not even, no, when I first hit, I just numb. I just had no pain at all. I didn't get the pain until quite a while after.
Once you were off the beach? Or whilst you were
on the beach? Well, when I was on the beach, when they carried me back, further back, I started to get a bit pain. And as I say, I couldn't see my arm. I didn't know what was wrong. I could see there was a lot of blood and things like that, but I couldn't see exactly what the damage was. And I couldn't see my legs. I knew my shoes were, my boots were off, because I'd blown my boots off when I got hit. I knew my boots were off, but I couldn't pull myself. Whether I was psychologically, I don't know, whether I didn't want to look or not, I don't know. But I never looked down at my legs or anything like that.
Now, we should say that your tank was recovered about 16 years ago, was it?
Yeah, after 32 years, it was recovered. 1976. That's when the army decided. Well, before that, they'd actually decided they were going to lift it. But they'd been trying to get in touch with me, apparently, and they didn't know where I was. They'd heard that I was still alive from friends that I have in France. Apparently, they're going to lift that tank. I thought, that's crackers. You know, couldn't understand it. So he gave me the telephone number, and he says, you've got to ring. So my wife rang him, and gave him details. He said, well, your husband's the man, by the looks of it, oh, the man we want. So the next thing I got a letter back from the unit in Germany, telling me the outline and what the feelings were and what they were going to do. And they wanted a tank that had been in action, which they thought might be in a reasonable shape that they could do up to take to Hornier to put on the barracks there. And after a lot of correspondence, they said that they'd made a date of when they were going to move it, or when they hoped to move it. And they came down into France, apparently, I think it was about 2 weeks before, to go to Serbia, the land, and they had to get permission from the French people about breaking the ground, because this bridge had to be broken. And apparently there was a telephone cable going right through, in national telephone cables was going through up to where the tank was. And I didn't know, where nobody knew then. And so that had to be Serbia, and made sure they could keep away from it before the road was broken. Then they came down, apparently, and they broke the road and had a good idea. Oh, well, I've made their own ideas of how they're going to lift it. It wasn't the way that I would have done it, personally, but I mean, I had nothing to do with it. But they decided what they were going to do anyway. And when they'd gone to lift the tank, when they'd gone to examine the tank, they'd lifted the turret hatch and just looked in. And they said, well, next thing I know, they wrote to me again and said they'd lifted the hatch. And there was so much ammunition and explosives on board. Could I tell them exactly what was on board? So I had to sit in that room. I was a bit concerned about the lads that was going to lift it, because I didn't know whether that studded boots or anything like that, because I was told that the explosives had started to turn to nitro. So I wanted to make sure that they knew exactly what was in it, that I could, as far as I could remember. And so I wrote back to them. I drew a diagram of the inside of the tank and placed everything where it should be. They went in, apparently, and got everything out, but they weren't allowed to explode it. The French army had to explode it. They took it down on the beach and exploded it. And they told us that our stuff was on board. My personal gear was still on board. All the crew's personal gear was still on board. all the ammunition. And a lot of the rations were still there. Some of the rations had gone because we had 14 days rations with us, just in case we couldn't get to, once we landed, in case we couldn't get to the trucks or the trucks couldn't get to us with the rations for the first fortnight. Except they had everything extra. We even had extra petrol. I carried a big cylinder of petrol on the back of the tank. 80 gallon on top of the back of the tank. Just extras, just so that we'd make sure we had plenty of petrol and everything for the landing. They told us that the corned beef was still edible and the chocolate that we had, was supposed to, each square was supposed to be a meal, and that was all still edible. But a lot of it's went to museums now. I mean, I did, when the tank was lifted and we went back and saw it being lifted, and then we went back a year after for the tank to be, take the flags off and that, like unveil it. And I asked my unit, I asked Bill Hortons and myself to go back and to unveil the tank with the help of some of the other lads that was there. They gave us our own gear. I got my razor back, I got my butter stick back, and they gave us a periscope out of the tank. I've got a little bit one or two of the things, but most of the things I've gone to museums now.
A tin of Freya Bentos was sent to Argentina, wasn't it?
Well, it was sent back to Freya Bentos. I didn't know whether it was Argentina or whether it was the firm, using the name across here or not, but it went back to Freya Bentos as far as I understand. And the one tin went to for examination, tested, and they said it was still edible. And then the other one tin's gone to one of the museums. I think it's gone to the one at Chatham, I'm not sure.
And the tank's now on display in
Bracema.
Quite an incredible story, that one. To hear it from his voice makes it even more remarkable. And to stand by that tank, to stand by those marshes, that flooded area, to see the dunes where his mates were killed, so very, very real. The three men that died that day, killed by the mortar bomb in the dunes, are all buried in our next stop, which is the Bayeux War Cemetery. And those lads were Sapper Roy Manley. He came from Croydon in Surrey. And the words chosen by his wife, the family inscription, the personal inscription on his grave, on his headstone, says this: "He left behind so sweet a memory that still he seems to live. Loving wife," she says. Next to him, in plot 15, grave A4, is another sapper, from one Charlie, Alfred Charles Batson. There is no personal inscription on his grave. He was 27, Roy was 25. And 30-year-old Eric George Hastings Phillips, he was a lieutenant, junior officer, in one Charlie. There is one word on his headstone that his family chose. His wife was Eileen, and they came from Surbiton in Surrey. All it says is the word through. Don't know why. They do. That's what's important. So let's now look at some of the stories that we looked at as we walked round the Bayeux War Cemetery. We got there in the morning for a special ceremony that had been put on by the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. It was the only public ceremony that was taking place. You had to apply for tickets, and they were issued to everybody that travelled with Ledger Battlefield Tours. We were fortunate to be there. We arrived quite early. We had to go through security. Everybody had to have a ticket and their passport with them. And then we sat there and watched all the people gather there. There was lots of local French children there. And that was good to see as well. They paid so much respect as they looked at the two veterans that were in the cemetery as well that played a part in the ceremony. There are 4,144 Commonwealth burials from the Second World War in Bayeux War Cemetery. 338 of them are unidentified. And as you walk down the left-hand side, as you go into the cemetery, you'll see different shaped headstones still looked after by the commission. But these aren't Allies. These are war graves from other nationalities, and the majority of them are German. And within those German graves are members of the SS, and no doubt soldiers, SS men that carried out atrocities. But we didn't linger on those at all. We weren't there to see them. Opposite the memorial itself is the Bayeux Memorial, and it bears the names of 1,800 men of the Commonwealth Land Forces who died in the early stages of the Normandy campaign but have no known grave. There was one Victoria Cross awarded following actions on D-Day, and that is for Stan Hollis after he came ashore on Gold Beach. But in Bayeux Cemetery, there's another Victoria Cross recipient. His Victoria Cross was awarded to him posthumously because he was killed in the action for which he was awarded the greatest honour there is in the British Army. He was Corporal Sidney Bates, 1st Battalion Norfolk Regiment, was killed in action on the 8th of August 1944, aged just 23. And to find out what he did, we went to his grave, we stood there and looked at his photograph, we read the citation. And then we wandered off, and a bit later I came back to his grave and I saw a number of French children with their teacher telling them the story of Sidney Bates. And I showed them the photo of him, and I couldn't speak French and they couldn't speak English. But it was a very appropriate moment, I suppose, as I watched that teacher telling the story of that young man. Such a brave young man, and this is what he did. Northwest Europe, on the 6th of August 1944, the position held by the battalion of the Royal Norfolk Regiment was heavily attacked. Corporal Bates was commanding a forward section of the left forward company, which suffered some casualties. So he decided to move the remnants of his section to an alternative position to which he could better counter the enemy thrust. As the threat to his position became desperate, Bates seized a light machine gun and charged, firing from the hip. He was almost immediately wounded and fell, but he got up and advanced again, though mortar bombs were falling all around him. He was hit a second time and more seriously wounded, but he went forward undaunted, firing constantly until the enemy started to fall back before him. Hit for the third time, he fell, but continued firing until his strength failed him. By then, the enemy had withdrawn, and Corporal Bates, by his supreme gallantry and self-sacrifice, had personally saved a critical situation. He died afterwards of the wounds that he'd received. It's almost beyond belief, isn't it, when you read that? This man had been shot and wounded three times, but still he got up. And still he kept fighting those Germans who fell back. And only when he collapsed because of the wounds, because of the three bullet wounds he'd got, only then did he stop firing. And no doubt save the lives of many of his comrades. Another grave that we visited in Bayeux Cemetery was the grave of Private Albert Dunstan of the 2nd Battalion, the South Wales Borderers. And he was killed in the Battle of Caen on the 14th of June 1944, aged just 18. He'd enlisted on the 3rd of September 1943, shortly after his brother had been taken prisoner of war. He wanted to join the army as soon as he could. And in May 1944, he waved goodbye to his sister, Elvira, on Pontypridd railway station. And he shouted at her, "Don't worry," and waved from the window until the train was out of sight. His headmaster had tried to persuade the family not to let him volunteer. He went to Normandy, actually on D-Day, with the first wave of the South Wales Borderers. And his sister, Elvira, said, "Albert wrote a few letters to us in the short time he was in Normandy, telling my parents not to worry, as he was quite safe. My other brother, Harry, was a prisoner of war." On the 14th of June, volunteers were asked for as there was a heavy battle taking place in a field nearby. "We were told in a letter from another officer that my brother was one of the volunteers and that he died through enemy action on that day." But as we said so many times in this podcast, regardless of which war it comes from, that the grief felt doesn't just end in 1945 or in a few years that follows. It travels down the years. Elvira and the rest of the family, the letters they wrote to Albert came back, stamped with just one word, "deceased," across it. She says, "To my parents, he was a wonderful son. To the rest of us, a lovely brother. We were all heartbroken, especially my mother, who only lived a few years after his death. I visited his grave in the British Cemetery at Bayeux, and my sons and other family members have been there too." It seems only yesterday that he was a laughing, happy schoolboy attending the grammar school. Albert told me he would finish his education after the war ended. Our brother's memory is as fresh in our minds now as it was 50 years ago. Our grief has never left us. Our thoughts go back to that day in May 1944 when she saw her brother for the last time and she said, "In my mind, I can see Albert's face smiling." And we have a photo of Albert. He's not smiling in that photo. He looks quite anxious. Perhaps he knew what was going to happen to him. And then at the back of the cemetery, we walked beneath the trees, the shadow of the bushes. We saw the beautiful roses that were out shadowing the graves. We found the headstone belonging to Gunner Albert Chettle, 144 Battery, 4th Battalion, Leicestershire Regiment, Light Anti-Aircraft Regiment of the Royal Artillery, was killed in action on the 10th of July 1944. During his time in Normandy, Albert sent letters home to his parents and his wife, who was called Lottie. The first is dated the 16th of June 1944, was written to his mother and stepfather. He tried to reassure his mum that he was okay and she should not worry, and he mentioned that the fact that the Japanese were being bombed, and he keeps using the phrases chin up and keep smiling. He wrote again to his mum and stepdad on the 29th of June. And the battalion diary, or the battery diary, tells us that they were supporting the Royal Scots and the 3rd County of London Yeomanry. In his letter, he again uses that phrase, chin up and keep smiling. It's not just Albert that was in Normandy, but also his brother Jack. And in the letter, one of the letters, this is what he says, "Dear Mum, Pop and all, many thanks for your letter the 21st, which I had last night. Pleased to hear that you're all okay and keeping in the best of spirits, same as myself at the present time of writing. I shall so tell our Jack he can look forward to that pint in the Brickies." And the Brickies, as he called it, was the family local pub in Welford Road, Leicester. "I keep looking out for him over here, but I haven't run into anyone I know yet. There isn't much else to tell you. Please write and tell Lottie that she can send you news as well. I will see her anyway. Remember to me all at home, take care of yourselves. Chin up, keep smiling, we'll close now." He wrote his final letter on the 7th of July 1944, just 3 days before he died. He was worried that some of his letters he'd sent home had gone missing. He says, "Many thanks for your most welcome letter, which I received last night. I can't understand why you haven't received the 3 other letters I've sent you. Pleased to hear that you are all okay, as it leaves me at the present time of writing. Lottie's keeping well, but worrying her head off because she hasn't heard from me either. Please write to her for my sake. How is the weather in England? Hope it's better than here. It's all rain. How are everyone at home keeping? Give them my regards and anyone else I know. Take care of yourselves. Soon we'll be seeing you, and then we'll have a good night out together. This is all for now, Mum. Keep smiling, chin up, and don't worry, we'll be okay. We're with the anti-tanks now. We'll close. Your loving son, Albert." There's about 20 kisses. Many of the missing letters that Albert had written arrived after he'd been killed, and he had a younger brother at home called Tony. He managed to intercept the letters before his mum got them. It had upset her so much. Albert had been killed on the approach to Hill 112, which we're going to talk about probably in the next episode. Now, after he was killed, his brother Jack tried to find out more about the circumstances, and he came across a Lieutenant Dixon. He sent a letter to him in September, described what had happened on the 10th of July 1944. He says, "Dear Sergeant Chettle, your brother was in the ammunition section of my troop on the day of the battle for Hill 112. He had come up in the truck with some ammunition. When the truck arrived in the battery lines, all the men got out and started digging slit trenches. About midday, they were told a meal was ready, and your brother had just climbed into the back of the truck for his mess tin when it received a direct hit from a mortar and caught fire. One of our sergeants, who was standing by, saw that Gunner Chettle was in the truck and he'd fallen to the floor. Regardless of his own safety, this sergeant rushed into the truck and dragged him out, but by this time he was dead. I'm very sorry to hear the news of his death, for even though I'd not known him for long, I could see that your brother was what we call a good lad and a good worker. He got on very well with the other fellows, and that itself says a lot. The sergeant who attempted to save your brother's life has been awarded the military medal. Please accept my feelings of deepest sympathy. And then Dixon also wrote to Albert's wife, Lottie. It's difficult for me, he says, as an unmarried man, to realise what a great loss you have sustained, and all I can do but offer you, in all sincerity, my heartfelt sympathy. He met his end purely by accident. We were in a position that was being heavily mortared, and I can assure you he suffered no pain and was not on the spot at the time, but we were pinned down on another flank, and it was not until some time later that I learnt what had happened. If there is anything I can do to help in any way, you only have to ask me and I shall do my best. And the last letter that we can talk about is from Jack, Albert's brother, to his mum, who he knows will be distraught, but he's in Normandy, don't forget. He's worried for his safety and he's worried about his mum. He tries hard to console his mum. And just listen to what he says. He says, "Dearest mother and pop, I've just received the sad news about Albert and I'm very sorry indeed. Try and take it on the chin and smile. It doesn't seem easy to do, I know, but remember that he died so that kids like Tony, Janet and Pat and all the millions born and unborn will never have to go out and do what we are doing now. It's hard to look at this that way, mother, darling, but please try, just for my sake. Keep the big smile for me and the world to see. It's upset me a lot, more than I can tell you, but I'll do my hardest to make sure that every shell lands on a square-headed hiney. I hardly know what to say about it, except that I'll take extra double care to keep out of harm's way, and I'll be back home as soon as it's over. Keep the old chin up. Au revoir, your ever-loving son, Jack. Good night and God bless." And those last few words, "good night and God bless," they're the words that form the family inscription on the headstone of Albert Chettle in Bayeux War Cemetery. Many years later, a British veteran visited Bayeux, and this is how he reflected on what he saw in that beautiful location.
"The main cemetery is in Bayeux. That's a great big cemetery. You're always moved when you see that cemetery. It's not a nice place, and yet it is a nice place. It's absolutely immaculate. It's very difficult not to be moved to read one, to read the gravestones and think that, well, I'm thankful it's not me."
Now, just going back to the British Normandy Memorial, as we were there, we looked down to our left, the tide was in, but we could just see the remains of the Moreby Harbour, the famous Moreby Harbour that, without a deep water port to support the invasions, the British, the Allies, took their own. One at Arromanche and the other one, which the Americans installed at Omaha Beach and which was completely destroyed. The Moreby Harbour at Arromanche is still visible, though that was also partially destroyed in a storm. As early as May 1942, Churchill had sent a memo to Lord Louis Mountbatten about the construction of these floating pierheads. The idea of taking their own harbour with them had been formulated, 2 years before the actual invasion. Churchill said to him, "They must float up and down with the tide. The anchor problem must be mastered. Let me have the best solution. Don't argue the matter." The various components of the Moreby Harbour were constructed in Britain, all over Britain, in complete secrecy, of course, towed across the Channel and assembled off the Normandy coast. Now, by the time the storm had taken place, 39,000 vehicles and 220,000 soldiers had used the harbour itself, and it wasn't long before the ports of Le Havre and Cherbourg were captured, meaning that it wasn't crucial that Arromanche was still used. So I think we need a break now from my voice. Let's hear again from one of the veterans. This is Richard Brock, who was serving on D-Day with the East Lancs Regiment, and he was speaking in this clip at Bayeux Cemetery at a special ceremony that was held in the evening of the 5th of June. This is what he said.
"Of the 130 lads in my company, only 19 of us made it home. in those desperate battles, they gave their lives for the peace we enjoy today. I will never forget them. My families and their families and friends will never forget them. We will remember them.
Arthur O'Bourne landed on Gold Beach and is with us here this morning. I am honoured to stand by the names of the friends he lost. He told me, "Not many people can say they survived a sniper shooting them through the chest, but thanks to my good friend Walther Gummerson, Gummy, as he was known to us, I can." He drove me to a field hospital, saving my life. The next day, my unit was ambushed, shredded, and every man was killed. I never saw Gummy again. That day, I lost 27 comrades.
It is all because of Gummy's quick thinking, his desire to help those around him, that I can stand before you today. I wish I could tell him I have never taken his sacrifice for granted and will always remember him and our friends. So, Gummy, thank you, my old friend.
And that was Arthur O'Bourne himself talking about his mate all those years later that he'd never forgotten. He was talking there at the Normandy Memorial on D-Day itself as part of the official ceremony. And then the actor Martin Freeman, famed for his portrayal of Tim in The Office, read the words written by one of the veterans who was also at the Normandy Memorial on D-Day.
Joe Mines, 2nd Battalion Essex Regiment, landed here on Gold Beach 80 years ago today. He joins us and allowed me to share these memories with you. I've never been back here for 80 years. I've often thought, what do I go back for? After all the terrible things I've seen, like a picture book up there, I can visualize everything. I landed on June the 6th, 1944, at a place called Vers-sur-Mer. The Germans pulled back, so it allowed us to clear the mines on the beach. That was the first job I got, clearing mines. All over the place they were. Joe Mines, clearing mines. One of our fellas trod on one and blew his leg off. The whole leg went. War is brutal. Back when I signed up, I met a fella on the train. I went to Normandy with him, but he got killed within about an hour of landing here. He was only young. I was 19 when I landed, but I was still a boy. I don't care what people say, I wasn't a man, I was a boy. And I didn't have any idea of war and killing. I was lucky. Yeah, I had lots and lots of luck. So why would I come back? Well, this is the last and only opportunity for me. The last there will ever be. And it's because of the lads. I want to pay my respects to those who didn't make it. May they rest in peace.
And there he sat in the audience, listening to Martin's words, clapping, waving to the crowd with his baseball cap on and his medals proudly on his chest. The only time that that man would ever return to the place that he landed on exactly 80 years before and where he lost that mate that he'd made on the train within an hour of the landings. And that was followed by some beautiful music from the actor and singer Johnny Flynn.
All the pace of my place to my lifted foot, the breath in my lungs to my lips, my tongue spoke back to the trees, to the ease, and my heart beat down with the rain down again, and I trod with an ache for the ones who walked before me, and joy for the ones who walked beside me. Solace the hills might give me, heavy the tread of the dead on the way, the bath in the rain and the sun won't gleam, and the ground is made with death and decay, and an echo for the ones who walk before me, and joy for the one who walk beside me. And the beach is lifting me, ash is reaching me, wind is holding me, time is folding me, under the trees, down through the lee, and on to the path that you came to that day. My heartbeat quickens, my breath deepens, footfall falters, your memory sold to the wound of calling your name. It's balm to the rain, I see you in forest trees. The ask its answer, I rise up tired but continue my journey. There's a light in the window, the first star is here. I find just enough peace to make my way home with sadness for the ones who walk before me, and joy for the one who walk beside me.
And above the town of Arromanch, a beautiful seaside resort where so many people had gathered in a wonderful almost party atmosphere to commemorate the liberation. Above there, a few years ago, was opened the D-Day 75-year garden. There was a man called Bill Pendle. He was chosen to represent the veterans, but sadly he passed away aged 97 in December 2018, just before the memorial garden was opened. Bill had landed on Gold Beach in 1944, aged 22, and with his family's blessings, two sculptures of him have been included in the garden. Bill was serving with the Royal Signals attached to the 11th Armoured Division. He followed the front line all the way through Normandy and into Holland, and he was there when Bergen-Belsen concentration camp was liberated, and the horrors he must have seen there are beyond our imagination. Throughout his service, he successfully delivered every message with which he was tasked, and went above and beyond the call of duty. He was awarded the Military Medal in June 1945 for bravery in combat. And when you go there, you'll see Bill's sculpture sitting on a stone plinth wearing his medals and beret. And then he looks across at another sculpture of his younger self about to land on Gold Beach on D-Day. There are four further sculptures of soldiers showing them wading through the waves as they navigate the obstacles that were there on Gold Beach. The sculpture of 97-year-old Bill is carved from a single block of millstone grit. 75 years separate those two scenes. People are asked to consider how it must have felt for the veterans when they returned to the beaches, and to reflect on the intense experiences that they endured, not just on D-Days, but on those long days that followed. Don't forget, there was another 11 months of hard fighting before the Germans finally capitulated. And we can listen to Bill's voice himself.
I did hear D-Day at 10 a.m. and the beach was littered with dead, wounded, prisoners of war, and also destroyed vehicles and craft. And there were things floating in the water that you don't want to remember. Now it's so peaceful and tranquil that you feel more at ease.
More at ease, he says, more at ease. I wonder if they ever felt completely at ease. But I suppose returning to the battlefields gave them some sort of closure, which in itself, I suppose, means that these old men now can live out the last few years of their life at ease. And this is another piece of recording from one of the ceremonies, and I think it sums up everything that I've tried to talk about in these first two episodes about D-Day. I've tried to put over how I felt, what I saw and what I heard during the week that we spent on the D-Day battlefields. Just listen to these words, because I think they summarise everything that I've tried to talk about, but in these words spoken by a professional actor, they're far more eloquent than I could possibly be.
Across the ports of southern England, as nightfall fell, some stopped to pray. A monumental operations eve was 80 years ago today. They watched and waited for their window, calculated tides and tempestuous weather. And as Normandy slept, the stage was set for a day that would change the world forever. The paratroopers prepared for their perilous passage. The Royal Air Force soared toward enemy lines, and a naval fleet of a scale unrivaled traversed a channel chocked with mines. And soldiers, most barely in their 20s, armed with fortitude so few acquire, faced with a fate we just can't fathom, each charged head first into that fire. For a second, contemplate that courage, that sacrifice so void of self, to give your life to foster freedom for the benefit of someone else. When the longest day was finally finished and they'd seized a foothold on that ground, because of all who bravely bore that burden, the Atlantic Wall came crashing down. That's why we dwell on D-Day decades later, why we mark such days from history, why we honor those that were dealt that duty and protect their lasting legacy. Why we gather together to give recognition. It's a promise, a vow that will not cease to show gratitude for the lives and the future they fought for in a safety and freedom that they'll never know. It's why we teach each fresh new generation to stay connected in one common way. And as long as their stories are never forgotten, we'll remember the people who gave us today.
Stirring words, aren't they? But I think what we ought to do in this second of the special podcast about D-Day is leave the final word to those veterans. I often wonder myself how they consider themselves and their role in the successful campaign. Well, let's find out, shall we? Let's see what they say.
Your life changes completely. You cope with what you've got and get on with it the best you can.
Age 20, I wouldn't have missed it for anything. I'm so glad that I can be talking to you about it. I can tell my grandchildren about it. and maybe even a great-grandchildren.
You must always remember somebody gave their life so you could be what you are today. And me, so I'm looking about what, 70-odd years of freedom. I've enjoyed my freedom.
But I was really glad to be able to do something useful instead of being a housemaid or something, you know. I think a lot of us were very juvenile before the war, and this gave us an enormous amount of independence, I think. It helped a whole generation of people my age. We were, from that moment on, we chose what we did. We didn't have to do what our mothers said.
We had first-hand experience of the war, and heaven forbid that anything like that ever happens again. I think it's history, and I think history is very important.
I often think the youth of today, I think they would have handled it the same. People say that they wouldn't have done, but I personally think I've done a lot of work with youth over my years, and I met some really good youth, and I'm sure they'd do exactly the same job as we did.
When you were in the service, you thought you were doing your little bit towards helping the war win. But unfortunately, it's not worked out right. We're still at wars now. And when this war, our World War II finished, we were hoping that would be the end of wars. But it's not.
Although we won, we and the Allies won the war, it didn't come cheap. There were lots and lots of young lives went. It's such a waste of life.
We get back now and thank God for how it'll be all young. Couldn't go to war again, don't I? I know all the dodges.
And did you feel like a hero?
No way. You was just another soldier.
Do you feel proud of what you did?
Now I'm 103, I often wonder why I've lived all this long, and so many of my mates and friends got killed.
Do you often think about them?
Yes.
Did you hear in that last clip how that veteran sighed when the interviewer asked him whether he thought of his friends? Of course he did. You could tell he was thinking about them at that very moment, and he probably thought about them every day for all of the 80 years that have passed since those men perished on a French field. The final episode in this series is going to be all about three soldiers, really. Three Canadian brothers called the Westlake Brothers. And do tune in for that, because often on Tales of the Battlefields I've talked about coincidences, but when I was telling the story of Westlake Brothers at their graves in a Canadian cemetery high above Juno Beach, something extraordinary happened. And I'm going to tell that story, their story, in the final episode coming up in a few days' time. But in the meantime, as usual, we'll play the last post to remember all of those men that died in the battle for the D-Day beaches and the following battles in Normandy. Thank you for tuning in.